I wrote a dystopian science fiction novel last year, and early in the book, I included this footnote. Quote, "Perhaps you're thinking, dear reader, that the world building in these pages is a little weak for a science fiction novel. That's because I'm portraying the near future, and the near future won't have flying cars and space empires. Due to declining IQ across civilization, we no longer get macro innovations like air travel and spaceflight. We get micro innovations, things like better smartphones, faster internet, better AI, etc., that entrench technology deeper into our lives. Until we break out of the statist paradigm, which is organizing society as a cult around the cathedral of corruption, the government, or until we get widespread implementation of human gene editing, producing an abundance of 150 IQ babies. Until we get one of those two things, all we'll have is micro-innovation in technology, which is what I portrayed in my science fiction novel. It's one of these dystopian science fiction novels set in the near future, but the coming decades that we're going to experience, they're just not going to be all that different than life is now because of this micro-innovation mode that our civilization is stuck in. I'm Jonathan Rosant with Limitless, and today I'm talking to a guy who I think is trying to change that. I'm joined by Dr. Andrew Kolarik, who is a very serious academic. But he's an academic that has, he's a very colorful guy. He's a traveling scholar. He's a nomad. And he has done entrepreneurship in a number of different fields. Dr. Kolarik, welcome to Limitless.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
Okay, first question. In my footnote there, in my book, I said that there are only two ways that we get civilizationally back into the mode of macro innovation, which is one, break out of the statist paradigm, achieving a truly free anarcho-libertarian society, or two, gene editing unborn babies for intelligence. And you know what? That footnote already feels dated just a year later, because a lot of people might say, well, like maybe generative AI can lend us the intelligence that we need to achieve macro innovations. But I think you've actually thought about this a lot more deeply than me. So what do you think? Why are we stuck in micro innovation mode?
All right. So good research in a university leads to more research, not development. Not commercialization, but more research. That's number one. Number two, the research that's conducted in universities are what's called incrementalized research. So we discover this one little thing, and now we do it again. And we discover this one little thing again, and again, and again. And so we're moving very slowly at a university level. So there aren't any great innovations that take giant leaps forward. Occasionally there are, but most of the research is conversational. So how can I put this? If you read, you pick up a research journal on artificial intelligence, each of those papers is a conversation with the people in that domain. Yes, it's called research. Yes, there might be some data. Yes, there might be some theory. But these are just conversations. And we incrementalize these conversations. We don't evolve them. That's the first problem. The second, and you mentioned AI, AI is not smart. It's diligent. It does what we tell it to do. It has a variability because they plug that into it. Sometimes it hallucinates completely. So it's not reliable. The human brain is far more reliable. And shifting our intellectual capacity to these machines is a road to disaster. Now, I'm not against AI. I like AI. I'm just a huge critic because it's been oversold. And I've been doing it. Texas Instruments and I, they gave me Lisp, 40 years ago to program in AI. So I've been messing with this stuff since its inception. Again, they don't know what they're doing. They've created variability within their statistical models and analysis. They have emulated conversation, so it seems like it's intelligent. But it's rather like talking to a stupid person. That's highly bureaucratic.
That sounds like the definition of hell to me.
Well, and again, if you talk to a bureaucrat who's not very bright, they'll get the job done. Okay? But you have to explain it in detail. You cannot allow for variability. Sometimes they will do crazy stuff because they don't understand, and so forth. And this is really what's going on with that sort of stuff. Now, what I've done is I've come up with a way that you don't have to have a 150 IQ to do real research, participate in the conversation by publication, learn faster than anybody else can. You're not reading books. You're reading source material. You're using your brain to organize and articulate it. And you're laying the foundations for real expertise. And I'm not a fan of this word expert. Okay, if an expert is simply, I know one more thing than you. But if you focus on a topic, on a domain, and really focus on it, you can become an expert real quick. You will have the capability of a professor without all the universities, without all the time, all the money, all the debt, and so forth.
So, okay, Limitless is, I try to make sure that in every episode, we are giving the audience like really practical things that they can use to multiply their effectiveness in life, to multiply their capacity to get to their goals. And a lot of times that means talking about biohacking or smart drugs. But this episode is, I think I'm going to categorize this as like an advanced personal growth episode, because this methodology that you have, which I convinced you to name it, and you came up with a great name, which was the problem to publication method. So this is an accelerated mastery framework that you've developed and have proven over the past two decades, right?
Yes. So I started as a PhD student, University of Auckland. I had no research background whatsoever. They accepted me anyways. They had me take a bunch of silly classes. They weren't very helpful. My supervisor didn't teach me how to do research. I had to figure it all out myself. So I went and I read 10 PhD theses in my topical domain. And I distilled them. What did they do? How did they do it? Under what circumstances do you, what kind of references are you looking for? And I spent some time hacking the system. I then read a whole bunch of things, took notes, and spent 6 weeks writing the first draft of my thesis. That took 6 weeks. The second draft, after feedback, 1 month. The third draft, 1 week. Submission, 364 days from start to finish. The university changed the regulations shortly after that, saying a minimum of 3 years. Now, I don't know if I had impacted that or not, but everybody was shocked that I was done. And I had fellow PhD students who were working on their eighth year. So I hacked the system. And then over the course of 20, 25 years, I refined it, I simplified it, I focused it, I removed all the nonsense, the thinking about thinking, none of that. This is how you do it from start to finish. This is how you get it done. And this is how you're going to learn.
Okay, so you accomplished in a year what takes a lot of people the better part of a decade. And I'm wondering, okay, there's high performers suffer from this misattribution error sometimes where we attribute an accomplishment to a system when, in fact, the inherent and individual properties of that individual are more to thank for it. Like, is this a case where your IQ was just a lot higher than your peers there in Auckland? Or is it a thing where maybe all of your peers were like binge drinking four nights a week and you were sober as a priest? I'm wondering how much of this, I wonder if you've thought about that. Like, how much of this is system versus like inherent individual talent? I mean, if it's something that's like that works for literally everyone, then that's awesome. That's almost like too good to be true, right?
Well, the origins is my own capacity. And I'm not afraid to say that. And it's not because I'm intelligent. Okay. People say I'm pretty smart. That's fine. I appreciate the compliment. There are days I'm dumber than a doorknob. Okay. Sometimes I just do stupid things. Other days I'm brilliant, a genius. Normal. That's how people are. But what started as something that was based on my own aptitude of process. I understand process and communication. I then, over time, learned to articulate it, formalize it, and systemize it. So the origin was me. But the outcome is now anybody. You do not have to be a genius. You do not need to have a bachelor's and a master's degree. All you need to be able to do is write a basic essay with references before you start. And the rest of it is hard work. And it is hard work because you're learning things in a way no one has told you how to do it. There's a lot of things in people's heads that was put there by other people. And at the end of this 12-week process, that stuff is gone. And I'm not rewiring your brain. you're rewiring your brain because you're getting firsthand knowledge. You're accessing what you want to learn, not what people tell you you have to learn, not what people say is expected of you, and so forth. And then you're organizing that substance into a proper form so that you can share it and have a conversation. It's not complicated. If I tried to do this, explain it, and teach it in full 25 years ago, I would have failed. I did pieces of it with people, and it was successful. And I that's when I figured out I actually had something here. But a comprehensive system at the very start, no. It's been in stages. It's been incremental. But now it's highly refined. Basically half of my adult life.
Okay. And, okay. Hey, Andrew. Dr. Kollarik, my mistake. Okay.
No, you can call me Andrew. All that title stuff just gets in the way.
Okay. Let me tell you about the conversation I had with my wife after me and you had our first conversation. I've always had a little idea bouncing around in the back of my head of a paper that, or of a study that I might conduct and a paper that I might publish, which is years ago, created a smart drug, a particular combination of cognitive enhancers that was, it was quite potent. It was one of the better smart drugs that I've tried out of the 200. And I've had this idea bouncing around in the back of my head for like the better part of a decade now, that what I might do one day is conduct a clinical trial, a placebo-controlled clinical trial, where I took this smart drug and I created placebo versions of it, and I gave it to a sales force. Like, I'd have to find a company that was somewhat risk-seeking and who wanted to, I would probably need to do it in a country where there was, like, where this was, like, legally not suicidal. But I'd go to a company and I'd propose that the salespeople, I'd get their consent in participating in a trial of taking this smart drug that I created and then doing a placebo-controlled test and seeing how much of an uptick in sales performance the salespeople had on it. Because this combination of cognitive enhancers was particularly good at enhancing communication skills. And then I could write a paper about, I could publish a study in one of the journals with the results. And I'm pretty sure it would actually result in a dramatic uptick versus placebo of a sales organization's performance. But I always talk myself out of actually doing this for a couple of good reasons. The whole legality of it is one of them. But the other reason is I don't know what the actual advantage would be of becoming a published researcher. I don't know what the actual advantage would be of getting my name into PubMed and into some pharmacology-related scientific journal for that kind. I don't know what the advantage would be beyond what I do now, which is publish educational content on the internet. So I'm curious. So for people what's the major advantage of actually having a paper that's published in a formal sense and accepted by one of those journals?
Okay, so is this an original cocktail blend of your own?
Okay. Pretty original. I would say original enough.
Okay, that's fine. If you have a concoction and we'll just call it a concoction, okay? I'm not disrespecting it, that produces in preliminary results significant improvement to cognitive function. You would need to articulate the compounds that are currently being used, what their downsides are, and so forth. That's the first thing. You need to distinguish yours from theirs. The second thing that you would do is you would need a structured environment to clinically prove what you think is a true result. By then publishing those results, you now have the foundation to state in any advertising clinically proven results. You now have commercialization backed by science. This is not voodoo anymore. This is not take a chance. This is now confirmed based on these processes and these results. This now has huge commercial prospects. Big corporations will buy it from you to distribute it. Think about stockbrokers. Their brains are flashing all over the place constantly. They have mental fatigue. This stuff would improve. It would also nullify the fatigue.
That's
trillions of dollars in profits. Legality? These people make the law. They would set up the clinical trials for you. This is the difference. And by the way, what I teach is not thinking about thinking. I want all my students to produce something with the potential of commercialization.
In 12 weeks.
In 12 weeks. And you'd be surprised how quickly this happens. When you read the literature that's out there, all right, let's say IEEE, okay? It's a way to get published. They have 9 million publications. There's no way to read 9 million publications. There is innovation to last a lifetime in those 9 million publications, all of them being ignored because the commercial industry doesn't want it. But in reading through what your particular domain is, your brain will start going, well, but what about this? And how about that? And why didn't they consider this? Your brain will start working out a solution by exposing yourself to a certain process and a certain assimilation of the content out there. You come up with some very interesting ideas. We don't create ideas in education now. It's ordered memorization. What I teach is thinking, not from some theoretical perspective, but by doing. And if people learn to think with the resources that are available, the academics are not all bad. People like to demonize them. They produce some incredible research. They don't do anything with it. Part of this process is going through the stuff they haven't done anything with and building on it for your own purpose. It's all there. There is enough innovation in the publications to last a lifetime. We're not using it, and no one's teaching you how to use it. And the moment you learn how to use it and apply it to a commercialization perspective, this is how you create businesses. This is how you change people's lives.
Can everything be commercialized? I mean, there's probably some areas of research where perhaps like altruism, some sort of like altruistic endeavor would be the end goal. Most people have a side of themselves, which is kind of a capitalistic side of themselves. And then they have another side of themselves that's pretty actually well aligned with that, that's more altruistic. So there's probably there's probably like one track of mentees that you work with that are like, okay, I want to have a minimal viable product after about 12 weeks. And then you also have some people that are like, okay, I want to start a nonprofit after 12 weeks. Could you give us some examples of those?
All right. So let me walk you through my process. And I'm going to show you how something as mundane as making tea has huge commercial prospects, but also can be self-rewarding.
Okay. I do
you
it,
can
every,
take it either I, way you want.
I do it every day. I have a black tea in the morning. I have a green tea in the afternoon for those great ECGCs. They're an amazing longevity compound. Yesterday, I had some really potent horny goatweed tea with my wife before a tantric session that really, well, okay, we want to keep this PG-13. So I'll leave that. I'll leave a lot of that out. But yeah, okay, making tea. I love it, man. Do it every day.
Okay, so the topic is, can we make a better cup of tea? The problem is bitterness. Now, there might be other problems, but we'll just say the problem we're studying is bitterness. The problem space is the whole tea ecosystem, from growing to harvesting to processing to distribution, preparation, so forth. There's theory behind making tea. There's plenty of documented theory. There's different ways of doing it based on temperature, volume of water to tea, concentration, so forth. So you can have a conversation in the first half of your paper that says why tea is important, why we need to know this. Also, it's $100 billion worldwide business. Okay? But some people just want a good cup of tea. All right? That's as euphoric as it gets for some people, and that's fine. Now you set up an architecture as to what this space of making a good cup of tea looks like. You need a methodology, temperature controls, weight, volume, so forth. You need a way to verify and validate your results, which would be a panel of tea tasters. So your architecture would have maybe 10 different ways of preparing the tea. And then you would prepare the tea according to the controls. And then you would have the tea tasters test it and rate it. You would write up your results, state your conclusions, your limitations, such as we only used one breed of tea, and future research. Maybe we should consider honey in the future. Now, that's a very simplistic model of what I teach. Is that commercial? Well, that depends. If one of those tea recipes, whether it's in the temperature or the volume or the breed or a combination thereof, creates a beautiful, wonderful taste without bitterness, now you have something commercial. You don't want to commercialize it. Now you have a family recipe. That's simple. But science doesn't really allow a lot of emotion in the process. You have to have a passion that goes beyond it to get it done. But the process is very mechanical, in fact. And what ends up happening is people go down the euphoric and they end up doing something practical. That's just how science works.
Okay. Last time you talked, we were talking about, I said, let's reveal a bit of the secret sauce of this. And you said, no love without truth, no truth without love. I like that, but it kind of sounds like a fortune cookie. What is that
right
practically?
Absolutely. It's a fortune cookie. Here's the reality. Institutions don't care about you. They care about your money. And once they have your money, then it's kind of a roll of the dice as if they're going to take care of you. They don't speak truth. They say whatever furthers their own agenda. And this goes for a lot of people in the education system as well. These are jobs. These are careers, and no one wants to risk their job or career. So they tell you what the institution wants you to tell them. If you want real teaching, you have to love your students, and you have to tell them the truth. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to be brutal. It doesn't mean you're going to be mean. That's why love is so important. If somebody produces something and I say, well, my opinion is the following, and you're probably not going to like what I have to say. It's not because I want to squash them. It's because I want them to lift themselves up further. If you don't love and speak truth, do both. You cannot get through 12 hard weeks. You have to have somebody who has the integrity and cares about you. And that's the secret sauce. Other people have tried to steal my system. I won't state which country in the Asia, but others have tried to steal it. And it has failed miserably because they don't speak truth and they don't love. Not in that process. They think it's purely mechanical. There's an emotional component to learning. There always has been. And if you don't have somebody who supports you, not in some abstract way, but truly cares what happens to you, not pseudo-empathy, but corrective, helpful response. You don't learn it.
Okay, so give us some examples of the mentees you've worked with and what they achieved in 12 weeks.
Okay, so let me start with one of my more difficult students, okay? So that this isn't all wonderful, fluffy rainbows and unicorns.
Yeah, please. That's a great example.
All right. So this happened in Vietnam. And for the first month of this class at a university, one of my students sat there scowling at me every day we met, scowling at me. She wasn't making progress. She wasn't doing very good. All of her other classmates were doing fantastic. Eventually, they all got together with her and they said, look, you really need to listen to what he's telling you. It works. So she did. And then the very next class, you know, we go through a series of processes. What she said was absolutely brilliant. And I looked at her, and again, truth and love. What happened to my student? And when did you replace her? That was brilliant. This is night and day. I don't know what you did, but you're doing it right. And it's wonderful to see. And from that point on, she stopped scowling. She went on to produce an incredible paper. Really good. And then she had no difficulty getting through her master's thesis with that paper. She then went back to work, and she used her research to produce products, software products, for her company straight from her research. I mean, that's, as far as I'm concerned, the best of examples, because you have somebody who fought me, agreed, tried it, did it, succeeded.
What kind of software was it?
AI.
Aha. In particular, though.
Well, she created a advertising algorithm that then was converted to a bot to answer questions.
Sure. Okay. Give us another example of, because we want to find examples that maybe listeners can identify with.
Sure. Okay, so I'll go back in time to the first batch of students in 2016 in New Zealand at a university there. These are social sciences and humanities students. I'm teaching in the security studies program. They're taking my class. One of my students produced a paper that evaluated small state potential for engaging in cyber warfare weapons.
Small state potential. So what would that be, like Andorra taking on Russia?
Yeah. Okay. So let's just say that I'm here in Georgia, and maybe Georgia's mad at Russia for some reason. Could they shut down their infrastructure? What's the likelihood that Georgia would engage in a cyber warfare program? Okay. Now, I suspect that's not an issue, but just as an example. But he did New Zealand instead, okay? And what he did was he built an assessment framework. And you then plug in variables into that assessment framework, and it says the likelihood or not likelihood based on a rational set of data input. Okay. Now, this is a very simple process that he set up, but it's a complex to think about. It's really, really beautiful the way he did it. So we published that in a conference. He then rewrote it and we submitted it to Joint Forces Quarterly, which has a readership of 2 million military people. 3 months after we submitted it, they printed it. That's unheard of.
Okay, yeah, that's a win.
He did not have a master's. That's now two papers. He wanted to go to the University of Victoria. So I made a phone call to the head of department there in their security studies. I sent him the papers. A week later, they sat down and met. A month after that, he was accepted to the PhD, and a month after that, he was given a full scholarship.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. Now, this is the sort of thing. There's the commercial track, and there's the academic track. My system doesn't care. My system lets you do what you want to do with what you've learned. You can do what you want. You can research what you want. And you can produce the results you produce.
We talked about cyber AI and cybersecurity. Have you worked with mentees in like the biosciences fields?
I have private students. I did have one student in the biosciences. But with my private students, I don't discuss their research.
Yeah, sure.
I don't add my name to their papers. I don't do any of that. I have a confidentiality agreement with my private students that says it's all yours and I don't say anything, so that they can be geniuses all by themselves.
Okay. And you had told me before that this is for like a 12-week thing, and the basic premise is like zero. You go from zero to published researcher in,
yes,
in 12 weeks. And that this is, for those 12 weeks at least, it's a fairly, or okay, it's like a part-time job kind of commitment. It's 20 hours a week. Yep. And then you said you spend about 3 hours a week on like a VoIP call with them, right?
Yeah, so it's 3 hours video conference. If it's a cohort, everybody meets together. If it's individual, just me and that person. And there's a series of activities. I don't teach content. I have 1.5 lectures. That's it. Everything else are processes, Q&A, exercises, investigations, articulations, feedback. It's not your traditional learning environment. There is no memorization. There is only articulation of what you've learned. My process forces the student to teach me what they've learned. If they can articulate what they've learned to me, then they've actually learned it. And they've ordered it in their mind so they can use it.
And that's a really big step in mastery, is vocalization. I will do, what's my best example of this? Okay, I'll do coaching sometimes with guys who, I'll do dating coaching with guys. In the past, I would do dating coaching with guys who are virgins, and I'd help them to lose their virginity, or some guys that are also not such hard cases. And what I would have them do is I would have them take up video blogging. And a lot of them would say, "Why? I don't really want to be a video blogger. Why would I start video blogging?" And I would explain to them that when there's topics that they're trying to master, because usually if a guy is trying to take his dating life to the next level, it's never just that thing. There's always all these other like peripheral areas of personal development that like he needs to be working on doing that. And so I would have the guy, I tell him, start making video blogs 3 times a week about what you're learning about nutrition or about social dynamics, and do these video blogs, and they don't have to be public. In fact, you could send them to me, or you could just delete them when you're done with them. But that would be a major step towards mastery, is the vocalization of what's being learned. So that's kind of what you do with your mentees.
Yeah, and it's both verbal and written. Okay. First, it starts with verbal, and then it moves into written. And with academia, there's a certain structure. And so that structure is taught. It's a simple structure. It's rather boring. But it starts by vocalizing it, then articulating it in writing in a certain structure. And when you're done, what you've produced sounds like it came from a professor. Now, the student that went on to do the PhD, they started having him be a teacher assistant. And the feedback he gave to me was he knew more about the subject than the teacher. That's funny. Okay. Because you could sit down and go learn it. I had another student that after he finished my course, I got some feedback from another professor who was mad at me. Because this one student in the middle of a class would go into the research databases, look up the stuff the professor was talking about, and then contradict the professor.
Yeah, they don't like that, do they?
No. No, the fact that you can go find the correct information in the middle of class quickly, they did not like that. And I got chewed out for that. But I'm proud of my student. Are you kidding me? That's exactly the kind of students we need. But this is the reality is a lot of what we're teaching people doesn't create independence. It doesn't allow them to think for themselves. It forces them to adhere to a template that somebody else creates. And if you want to hack your own mind, you have to break that mold.
Okay, here's a good question. What are the, in your quarter century experience, what are the biggest learning mistakes that you see people making? What are the mistakes where people are trying to achieve mastery of a subject and they've got a lot to learn, they need to go from zero to hero, and they fail to do so? What are some of the mistakes involved with that?
All right, so the first thing that I saw, one of the students, PhD students I was with, is he tried to be his supervisor. He tried to think like his supervisor, tried to write like his supervisor, idolized his supervisor. Now, I don't have a problem with any of that, except you can't produce original research by copying.
Yeah, no, of course not.
It does, well, but you'd be surprised how many people try it. The second mistake is that people say, is there a template? I get asked this all the time. Is there a template? No, there is no template. We make this up all from zero. There's no template. There's a process. And those that cannot figure out there is no template get stuck. Okay? The third thing that I found is they go down a road and they can't change their path. What's in their mind versus what they are finding, they can't alter. So for instance, I had one student that told me that surveillance is critical. We need surveillance, state surveillance. I said, okay, go read up this, and you know, I gave her some reading. And a week later, she came back and said, surveillance is evil. So, people get fixated on what's in their mind. And the people who can produce good work think for themselves. Surveillance, in that example, is both good and bad.
Yeah,
there's nothing wrong with surveillance. It's just a technology. It can be used properly or it can be abused. And so people start with this ideological perspective. They can't get it out of their head. And it screws everything up.
Okay. So dogmatism or clinging onto a presupposition sabotages learning. And is that the biggest mistake you see people making?
I think so. There's lots of little stuff, but the ideological bent is the biggest obstruction. A lot of people have been conditioned. Okay. You know, for instance, free market system is not the same thing as capitalism. Capitalism ends with ISM, It's a political ideology.
Mm-hmm.
Political ideology consumes people to further it. I don't care what ideology it is. People get hurt to further the ideology.
Yeah, ideology is what they call a, there's a phenotypic revolution. There's been phenotypic revolutions that occurred when DNA took over from RNA and it enslaved RNA to work for it. And then when human beings invented ideology because it was evolutionarily advantageous for like our kin selection. But then memes or ideology, ideas, viral ideas that have a life of their own, these became a new, they really are a new evolutionary life form, and throughout history, they have the capacity to enslave human beings to do their will. And then many would argue that we're on the precipice of fourth phenotypic revolution with the invention of AI, which will enslave us potentially. But that's kind of a much bigger discussion. But so that's what your nugget after a quarter century of doing this is that ideological bent is the biggest speed bump to accelerated mastery of some topic.
I would say that that's true. The other thing I would add is a lot of the ideologies haven't been thought through. They've just been accepted. After, 5 or 6 years for a bachelor's, 2 more for a master's, 10 years for a PhD, all that time in the universities, ideology is being put in you. How do you learn with all this ideology being imposed? This is why it takes so long. There is zero ideology in my curriculum. In fact, if you use ideology, you're probably only going to hurt yourself. As I like to tell my students, there's a road to pleasure and prosperity, and there's a road to pain and suffering. And ideology is a road to pain and suffering. And it really is.
Okay. And so ideology is defined by worldviews that kind of involve like a should. Like these things should, human beings and society should work this way. It's kind of involved. So ideology is the domain of moral judgments about the way things should work, whereas your methodology is more focused on observation of reality.
Yes. Yeah. The scientific method is all about observation, testing, and consideration of the results. It's a very simple process. There is no substitute for human intuition. There is no substitute for anecdotal evidence. Okay? However, if you want to prove it on a large scale, that's where the scientific method comes in. Because not only are you proving your method, but other people can validate your method by doing it as well as a separate research. They can replicate. If your research can be replicated, then it has real standing. So let's go back to your biohack concoction. You publish the paper. You publish the data and the results. Somebody else could run the same test and validate it. Now you have third-party confirmation.
So the way that you work with people is you prefer that they fill out a form on your website. Or last time we had talked about this, we had talked about like potentially doing like a small chunked, like 5-day version of your methodology that you could put people through. Is that, what's the status of all that?
All right. So I did at Corvinus University in Budapest, I did a 5-day course for them. 8 hours a day, 5 days, Monday through Friday, with master's and PhD students. And several of them said it was the hardest course they'd ever taken in their life. My curriculum wasn't really designed for that kind of compression. And I wasn't able to teach everything because there's no time for the students to produce multiple iterations, because you spend 8 hours learning and then you're going to spend 8 hours at night working. But the results were still the same. While I didn't have a publication at the end of it for each student, shortly thereafter, they all produced publications and they all published. In fact, they went on to do more than one.
All of them. How many was it?
I think there was like 30 students.
Wow, really?
Yeah, once you lay the foundation, once you establish what needs to be done, then the rest of it is just carryover. It's momentum. Being able to articulate why something is important lays the foundation. The rest of it is easy. And, you know, the students, I mean, and they were doing all kinds of different topics. So it's not just technology. It's whatever they wanted to do. But where most people have problems with research is the initial articulation. Why is something important according to the academic literature? And then how do you design an experiment or a survey or a whatever? How are you going to build on what somebody else has already done? And it's I didn't invent this. I refined it. This comes from the Greeks, Aristotle, Plato. I've just modernized it.
Okay. And so is there a 5-day program, or is what you have to offer right now the 12-week program?
Well, right now I have the 12-week. But if I were to get a cohort that wanted to do a 5-day, I would do it.
Okay. What now? I would just, okay, what I'd ask you is if someone in my audience comes over to your website and fills out your form, if someone gets in touch with you and their idea is just fundamentally unsound, if their hypothesis and their publication is just unsound, like how do you work with that? Do you tell people, sorry, this is BS, I don't think this is going to go anywhere, tough love? Or is it a thing where you say, maybe let's try and see? Like, have you turned down mentees?
No, I haven't turned down a single student, because even if they start in a point that doesn't sound tenable, after they go dig into the material, they come to that realization themselves.
Okay, good. Yeah, that sounds better. Because if some figure of authority shoots down your baby idea, then you sometimes get like invested, obsessed with it. But if you can uncover, if we can uncover like the failures in our own thinking on our own, then that's like an ego prick that we all tend to take better.
So let's say that there's an untenable proposal. I had a student that wanted to use AI to build trading models for stock options or something like this. And my initial assessment was, theoretically, that will work. Practically, AI is not ready for it. And he kind of got mad at me. And I said, I'm not going to tell you don't do it, but I'm going to suggest you go read up on it in these journals and find out for yourself if anybody else has even grasped the very beginning of doing something like this. And a week later, he came back and said, I'm changing my topic. And this is how it works. Now, I still state what I think. I still state what I observe. I know what works. I know what doesn't work. But I also don't know everything. I don't claim to know everything. It's not my job to know everything. My job is to help you learn what you want to learn and to do it in a way that you can make use of it. And that's really all there is to it. And by the way, if somebody comes to my website, fills out the form, or just gives me a call or sends me an email, I can make a custom course for them. Okay? There'll be limitations. The outcomes will be different. But I can create a custom course. I only charge for my time. That's really what this is about. And if some billionaire decided to give me an endowment, I would do this for free. If I never had to worry about money again, I would do it for free for anyone who wants it, to be blunt. That's how invested I am.
Because no love without truth, no truth without love. Dr. Kollerich, okay, so yeah, so I sure hope I hear from some people that take you up, because like I introduced at the beginning, civilization is badly in need of macro innovation. And in fact, we need a couple of good macro innovations to pass through Fermi's great filter in the next couple of centuries. We need a couple of pretty good macro innovations to avert the doom of our species. So yeah, I hope that there's some people that are inspired. And speaking of things that might give you inspiration, you took a crack at my book Hourglass while you're there in Georgia, right?
Yes.
Well, okay, give me your honest feedback on that, if you've whether or not you finished it.
Okay, so first, let me qualify. I'm not a big reader for enjoyment. I read a lot as part of my work, and so I don't really like to read much. So please don't be offended that I didn't read all of it, okay? Secondly, I spent my summers in Hollywood. My father was a TV and movie producer and distributor. So when I read your book, the way it's written, it's like small pieces of a puzzle that you have to assemble in your own mind to create the bigger picture. And this is perfect for Hollywood. I think somebody should write a screenplay for your book. I think your book would make a nice movie. That's my honest assessment.
Thanks. That's what every author wants to hear about their book, that this would make a great movie. But it's in the future, I might look at hiring a really crack AI filmmaker and having them produce it, because I don't care to master the craft of filmmaking. That's one of those things that I think I could probably spend 2 years working my ass off at it, and I'd still probably be pretty bad at it. So maybe in the future, I can hire a filmmaker. But yeah, thanks for taking a crack at it. And as a listener takeaway, I hope that some of my audience can just think about topics that are within their grasp of mastery, that there's topics, and I even have a few myself, there's topics that we all have that are kind of within our grasp of mastery, that we could become masters of them with, if we're willing to put in a, if we're willing to start with that first 20 hours. That first 20 hours makes a really big difference. And so, yeah, so maybe just give some thought about that. Is with the time left this year, is there a topic that you've always wanted to get closer to that you could put in 20 hours this year into, like a focused 20 hours? Think about that. I'm Jonathan Roseland with Limitless, looking forward to a continued conversation with you.
Onto the campus with a proud, ambitious gaze, ready to unleash your brilliant mind upon the maze. You dreamed of giant breakthroughs that would make the paper spin, refusing to accept the slow decay of what had been. But you entered a machine that doesn't care for giant leaps, where the independent fire of the youthful thinker sleeps, and the status paradigm of the cathedral holds the door, demanding orderly memorization and little dusty lore. Academically ensnared, you fail to rise above. No love without truth, no truth without love. In the maze, you become mired in banality. Sip some tea with your inconsequentiality. You wanted macro innovation to push the species high, to build the rocket engines that would colonize the sky. But the bureaucrat in charge explained the rule of university space. Leads to more research to stay inside the race. So we focus on the micro, making increments so small. A tiny conversation that does nothing much at all. A paper to reply to what another paper said. Just incrementalized gossip of the living and the dead. They accepted your tuition, took your spirit and your gold, then wrapped you in a dogma that is centuries old. They taught you thinking about thinking to delay the actual deed. Adhering to a template that will never let you lead. You tried to copy the professor, speaking only in their tone. Terrified to have a single concept of your own. But institutions do not care about your individual sight. They only care to keep their cozy structures safe and tight. Academically ensnared, you fail to rise above. No love without truth, no truth without love. In the maze, you become mired in banality. Sip some tea with your inconsequentiality. Inside your office 20 years along the line, a minor cog locked tight within the bureaucratic design. Your grand dreams of macro progress have collapsed into the clay. As you proofread student essays, at the ending of the day, you became the very bureaucrat you once held in disdain. A gatekeeper of the system, keeping everything the same. An expert on a tiny sliver of an ignored domain. While civilization languishes in intellectual pain. Academically ensnared, you fail to rise above. No love without truth, no truth without love. In the maze, you become mired in banality. Sip some tea with your inconsequentiality. You didn't incarnate for inconsequentiality. The inane deserves your fiercest ire. So escape.
escape the cathedral and edify yourself at limitlessmindset.com.